Eglah Rufa is the ritual in Judaism, which begins when a body, a dead body, is found in between two cities, and the mystery—it's a mystery. We don't, no one knows who committed the murder. You might have imagined that in a society where there's an unsolved murder, that there's nothing to do, so you don't do anything. But the Torah has a series of rituals, let's say, which take place when you find this unsolved mystery, dead body situation. And that's what we call Eglah Rufa. The ritual that the Torah tells us to perform is that it's called Eglah Rufa. We take a calf and we break the skull of the calf as part of a ritual. Now, I'll already spill the beans at the beginning, and I'll say that there are three different theories as to where Eglah Arufa comes from. And almost all of the laws of Eglah Arufa, almost all the laws of Eglah Arufa are things which could be understood in one way or another. And so when we talk about Eglah Arufa, it'll be a very interesting question to figure out whether a particular law of Eglah Rufa supports one theory of Eglah Rufa or another. Okay, now, what are the three theories of Eglah Rufa? So the first theory of Eglah Rufa, this will sound familiar from our discussion related to Ir Miklat, the one theory is that it's designed to get a repentance for some sort of culpability that derives from the fact that there is a dead body in our midst. In a broad sense, right, we don't want to have a scenario in which there are dead bodies, where there are people who die, and therefore, in a very, very, very broad sense, in a very, very broad sense, we just don't want we feel guilty, we feel like we have to right the wrong of some sort, and as a result, that's why we have a Eglah Rufa. Ooh, and I just entered a second time. That's weird. Okay, so that's theory number one. Any questions on theory number one about why we have Eglah Rufa and what it's trying to teach us? Now, this first approach can be understood in a way that is very mystical. Mystically, there is, blood that was spilt. And the blood that was spilt needs to be expunged from the land. The last, one of the last few verses of the Eglah Rufa ritual in the Torah actually speak that way. So in the Torah, at the end of the Eglah Rufa story, the one of the last few verses are, "Kaper le'amcha Yisrael asher padita Hashem." God, atone for Israel, the nation that you redeemed from Egypt. V'al titein dam naki, and do not allow the guilt of innocent blood to reside bekerav amcha Yisrael, in the midst of the Jewish people. V'nikaper lahem hadam, and the blood shall be annulled for them. This pasuk with kapara mentioned twice, dam naki mentioned twice, amcha Yisrael, the nation Israel, brings us in that direction of this sort of mysticism that there's this blood that needs to be avenged and the Jewish people need to do something about it. This is interpretation number one. This is, on the totally other extreme, is an incredibly rationalistic approach, which is suggested by the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, that the whole reason why we have this ritual is just to publicize the death in an effort to look for witnesses. If you have a scenario in which there is a body found in between two cities, there might not be witnesses who saw what happened. And if there are witnesses, they might be in a different city. When the private eye, when the police detective comes to the city, comes to the scene of the crime, the witnesses aren't going to be there. How are the witnesses going to know that a murder even occurred? So we have a ritual which is very bizarre and very public and involves lots and lots of going back and forth. And the purpose of that is that people will see, people will hear, and witnesses will come forward. Now, these first two interpretations are radically different from another. According to the first, everything about the ritual is specified as the way to achieve atonement. According to the second approach, it's not about the atonement, and even the details of the ritual are not even as critical. What's more critical is just that in the end of the day, the murder has been publicized. I'll already let you know that I prefer the third explanation. The third explanation says that it's not an amorphous culpability that the city holds. The city really is guilty because a city is responsible for a murder that takes place in its vicinity. Now, you might ask why. And here we need a little bit to enter the historical context in which the Tanakh would have been written. The roads are dangerous at the time of Tanakh. There's no central authority. There's no central police force. And if you are traveling at night, who knows, what could happen. It's for that reason that there are numerous examples in the Tanakh. We know this historical context from the Tanakh. There are numerous examples in the Tanakh of people who are afraid to travel at night. Can anyone think of any examples of people who are afraid to travel at night? The most famous example is Yaakov in the beginning of Vayetze. It says, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Harana. Yaakov is traveling. Vayifga b'makom. He reaches a particular space. Vayalen sham, and he goes to sleep, kiva hashemesh, because the sun has set. The sun has set, and Yaakov says, I got to stop. He's not going to travel at night. Vayikach me'avnei makom vayasem merashotav, and he's so worried about what might happen to him overnight that he takes stones and he puts them around his head to protect himself from the dangers of the road. When the brothers visit Yosef, in Parshat Miketz, to buy food, it says, Haboker Or, when the morning light came, V'lanashim Shuluchu, and the gentlemen were sent from Egypt, they traveled during the day. In the story of Pilegesh Begiva, and the end of Sefer Shoftim, the gentleman who's traveling is frantically looking for a place to stay at night. You don't travel at night, that's the rule. So when there is, God forbid, a person who's found dead between two cities, the assumption must be that he either came to a nearby city and they didn't provide him with lodging, or they provided him with lodging, but they allowed him to leave the city under dangerous circumstances. They didn't accompany him. They didn't provide him with enough provisions. The third approach says there is culpability on behalf of the city, but it's not amorphous. It's real.
because the city should have done more to protect him. So according to the first approach, that the city has to get a kapara, an atonement, I would say that, yeah, perhaps the Torah assumes that the murderer lives in one of these cities. According to the second approach, that you want to encourage witnesses to step forward, I might also assume that the murderer lives in one of these cities. According to the third approach, the sort of danger of travel approach, I would say the exact opposite. The Torah assumes that the murderer does not live in any of these cities. It's some sort of highway bandit who committed the murder. The culpability of the city is not grounded on the fact that the murderer has anything to do with the city. The culpability on the city has to do with the fact that if this city was a welcoming city, no one would travel at night. People would just stay in the city. If people were to travel at night, they would send a guide with them, make sure that the person is able to travel with safety. The murderer is not from the city. The murderer is from the outside, you know, sphere. But the city is responsible because they're still responsible for making sure that, you know, the murderer is not affiliated, you know, making sure that the travelers have the protection that they need. Okay, this was let's now take a look at some of the laws associated with Egla Arufa, the ritual of the breaking of the head of this calf, to see how these laws perhaps relate to the theoretical background. I'll read from the Rambam in the ninth chapter of the laws of Rotzeach Ushmirat HaNefesh. The Rambam writes, Harog shenimtza nofel la'aretz v'lo noda mihikahu. A harog, the first word the Rambam uses here is a harog. The Rambam is making it clear that this unsolved mystery is an unsolved murder. It appears that the individual is harog, killed by another human being. If the person is, seemed to have been attacked by a wild animal, torn apart by a wild animal, you don't indicate this rule because all three of the explanations say it relates to culpability for a death. If an animal, were to do it, it's harder to have that culpability. And therefore, if it's a harug, somebody is killed and is found, menichin oto bimkomo, you leave the deceased in place. The yotzin chamisha zakeinim ebeista nagadol shebi Yerushalayim, and five elders come from the high court in Jerusalem. Shneamar, as it says, v'yatzu zekeinecha, zekeinecha in plural, your elders, v'shofetecha, and your judges, also in plural, so 2 plus 2 is 4, 4 judges, u'modedin mimenu el ha'ir, shebisvivo techalal, and you actively measure to the closest city, as it says in the verse, u'modedu el ha'arim asher svivo techalal, there is an actual requirement to measure to the city. Even if there's one city which is right next door and it's clear that this is the closest city, you must measure. This first collection of laws related to Egla Arufa actually supports the rationality, let's make a whole to-do about this, more than anything else. Normally in Judaism, how many judges are required for a rabbinical court? Normally 3, but here we say 5. It's very hard to find something in Judaism that requires a court of 5. There is an opinion in the Gemara that for this a court of 3 suffices, but the Rambam says a court of 5 based on the verses. Why such a, greater sort of public event than normal? Also, why the rule that you have to measure if it's clearly next to one city? Cities had walls. If somebody is found deceased 20 feet outside the wall of one city and the next city is 500 feet away. Why do you have to sit there with a tape measure? And you know how hard it is. You have the tape measure, then your tape measure isn't long enough, so you have to move the tape measure in the other direction. Why do you have to measure if we know which one is closest? These laws actually suggest the theory that there's no real purpose to any of this, as much as we are trying to publicize what happened. We are trying to publicize what happened. People are going to see, why are there five elderly judges from Jerusalem who traveled all the way here to measure cities? Why are they taking a tape measure to measure from one place to the other? They'll see what's going on, and that will publicize that there was a murder. This first selection of halachot really supports that theory that the purpose of this is to publicize what happened. However, continuing to halacha beis in the Rambam, the second halacha in the Rambam, we'll now see other halachot which seem to be less focused on publicizing what happened. In halacha beis, the Rambam writes, "Achar shemodedin v'noda ha'ir hakrova." After you've measured to the next city, the nearest city, "Kovin ataneirag bimkomo." You bury the deceased in the place that he passed away. The elders of Jerusalem go back. They bring a calf. Michel Anche Otoir that they pay for themselves. And they bring that calf to a very specific place. El Machal Shotef Bachazka, to a fast flowing river. The Torah calls this a Nachal Eitan, which the Rambam says is a fast-flowing river. Now, if I told you that according to the Torah, you have to take an animal and end the life of that animal in a very, very specific place, what would that remind you of? It would remind you of a sacrificial ritual. Now, if the whole purpose is to publicize, I understand why you're doing the measurement and why you have a whole to-do, but why something that looks like a sacrifice? Just get like a crier and have him cry, you know, somebody died, somebody died. The specification that it needs to be a calf and that it needs to be in a particular place where the water is flowing suggests something which is much more sacrificial. I'll just note as an aside that this word etan that appears in the Torah, that the calf is the calf is sacrificed or killed in this nachal etan. There's a big debate between Rashi and the Rambam what a nachal etan is. They disagree about both the word nachal and the word etan. Nachal in Hebrew is a very funny word. And if you live in America, it's hard to see why these two English words would have the same Hebrew word. The word nachal in Hebrew can mean either a river, or in Hebrew, it can also mean, yeah, like a valley. Now, in the United States, it's very hard to understand why you would use the same word for river and valley. Because you think of a valley, you think of a, you know, wide spot in between two mountains, and there's almost never water there. The water is usually drained out of that area. When you think about rivers, you think about these wide places where water flows 365 days a year. When you consider Israel, you realize that a lot of the valleys and rivers are actually the same. And if you go there in March, it's a river, and you go to that same exact place in August, and it's a valley. So that's why in Hebrew the word nachal can actually be used for either situation. As a result, the Rambam is saying nachal etan means a strong or forceful river, so you're going to take the life of this calf at a strong river. And Rashi says it's a strong valley, namely a hard valley, a valley which has never been tilled. When you prepare the earth for agriculture, you till the earth and you soften it. So the Nachal Eitan is done in a sort of barren valley, which is not used for agriculture. If we were trying to create a pseudo-sacrificial ritual in order to effect a atonement for a murder, doing it in a sort of barren, untilled, unworked patch of land is exactly the kind of place I'd imagine doing. The Torah does require that the calf never have worked, and that helps in two ways. Number one, it further suggests a sacrificial nature of this calf because it's a sacrifice, and the other sacrifices, also the paraduma, for example, is another sacrifice where you can't have laid a yoke on it, and also it fits with Rashi's explanation of the Nachal Eitan, the sort of pure, untouched, and barren space, just like this life was ended, unable to produce fruits. So too, we take a calf, which has never produced fruits, and a lamb, which has never produced fruits, and we do this ritual in order to effect an atonement. Halacha Bet very much suggested things related to a sacrificial nature. Halacha Gimel, maybe not. Halacha Gimel says, v'orfin oto sham, and we smash the skull of the animal, bikupitz, with a large metal axe, me'achara, in the back of the head. If this were sacrificial, we'd imagine not breaking the head. We'd imagine instead slaughtering, right? All sacrifices are slaughtered. So that doesn't seem also so much sacrificial. And also, if this were sacrificial, who would we have take the life of this calf? We'd have a Kohen do it. The Rashash, Rabbi Shmuel Strashon, notes that there is one section of the Talmud which implies that a Kohen has to, kill the calf. This Rambam seems to suggest it does not have to be a Kohen. And I would suggest that perhaps the debate between whether a Kohen is required is whether you see this as sort of our first view, that it's a pseudo-sacrificial atonement ritual, then it has to be effected by a Kohen. And maybe that's what the Gemara is saying in the one location that it requires a Kohen. But the other locations in the Sifri and the Gemara and Sota and the Rambam, which don't say it has to be killed by a Kohen, maybe they adopt the third view that the city is guilty of something, so they have to pay for the value of this calf. They have to lose something as a punishment, but a priest does not need to effect it because it's not sacrificial in nature. The continuation of the ritual in Halacha Gimel will support either the first interpretation that it's a atonement, or the third that it is a sort of a punishment for the city not doing their responsibility. Uveis din shalosa ha'ir, and the court of the city, im kol zekeneha, and all of their elders, afilu hem mea, even if they are 100, rochatzinet yidehem sham, they wash their hands there, as the Torah says, "Barachatzu et yedehen al ha'egla harufa banachal." They wash their hands on top of the calf. What do you make of the fact that they're washing their hands does support the river theory, or else where else will they get the water from? What do you make of the fact that all of the elders need to come out? Yeah, I mean, does that imply everybody's responsible? The elders can't point to the other elders and say, it's their fault. Can they point to the other elders and say, there was a bill
to pave the roads, and they voted against it, and they had the majority, so it's not my fault that we didn't pave the roads. Now, all 100 are responsible. If you think a bill should be passed, you have to get the other, you have to get the other side to support it. While they're in the midst of that, so one of the interesting things about this in general is that normally the sacrificial order in Judaism takes place only in the temple. There are three examples of sacrifices which take place outside of the temple. The first is the Seir Mishtaleach, the goat on Yom Kippur, which is, you know, sent off to a barren, wasteful land, and it's killed, thrown off a cliff almost. The second is Parah Aduma, which is performed on Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, is where the Parah Aduma is slaughtered. It's actually not in the temple. And the third is the birds of the Metorah. Somebody with Tarat, when they are cleansed of their Tarat, there's a ritual involving killing some birds, which is outside of the camp. Part of why those three paradigms are so important is that it's a huge deal when I claim, I mean, when some authorities claim that this is a sacrificial ritual, because in Judaism, we don't have sacrificial ritual outside of the temple. But the reason why those other three examples are so important is that the existence of those other three examples might allow us to say that this is sacrificial as well. Now, the Parah Aduma must be done by a Kohen. The birds of the Metorah also are performed by a Kohen. Regarding the goat on Yom Kippur that is thrown off a cliff, that does not need to be a Kohen, although the Kohen Gadol has laid his hands on it. So there is a parallel to other sacrifices outside of the temple. Although the other ones do have a Kohen, a priest, involved much more in the center than this ritual. This ritual is really focused on the Zakenim, the elders, which is why, as I said at the beginning, I prefer the third approach, that I don't like saying that this is a sacrificial kind of thing. I prefer the third approach, that it's the elders who are responsible, and we're trying to, I don't know, shame the elders, or at least the elders have to own up to the fact that the elders of the city and the court of the city are responsible to make sure that they welcome guests, that they protect the travelers, and they didn't do so. After the calf dies and after they wash their hands, that also is like the first or the third approach. It's like they like Lady Macbeth, you know, there's some guilt on their hands, so they're washing their hands to remove the guilt of the blood that's on their hands. After that, Omrim Shan B'toch HaNachal B'Lashon HaKodesh, they remake the following recitation in Hebrew. Normally in Judaism, you don't have to declare things in Hebrew. Normally you are allowed to declare things in the vernacular. Prayer is permitted in the vernacular. You're allowed to daven in the vernacular. There are a lot of things that can be done in the vernacular. When people get married, it's customary to pronounce the marriage pronouncement in Hebrew, but that can be pronounced in the vernacular. Here it has to be in Hebrew. Does that sound like maybe it's more sacrificial if it has to be in Hebrew? They say, the elders recite the words, which again indicate that they have culpability, not just that we're publicizing this, but that they actually have guilt. Yadeinu lo shafchu et adam hazeh, we did not commit this murder. Ve'einenu lo ra'u, and we did not see. The language to me really supports the third approach, because they're saying we didn't commit this murder. And as Rashi points out in his commentary on the Pasuk, did we think that 100 elders committed the murder together? According to our first approach, the point is that they
that they're sort of getting an atonement for the blood, and it's irrelevant guilt, culpability, they're achieving an atonement. It's precisely according to the third approach that these words make sense. Yadeinu lo shafchu et adam hazeh veineinu lo ra'u. We didn't kill him. Why do we think you killed him? Because we're almost responsible for it. My lady does protest too much, right? Why do they have to keep saying, we didn't do it, we didn't do it? The reason why they're saying we didn't do it is because the Torah says, you kind of did. You kind of were responsible. And that's why they have to declare that they're not responsible. It's shameful that the rabbis have to get up there and say, we didn't commit a murder. But the reason why they're doing that is because the Torah is saying they kind of did. They kind of are responsible. And that's why they have to go through the indignity of actually saying it. Klomar, the Rambam continues, as does Rashi. It's not that he came by and we didn't give him enough food and that led him to travel during the night because he didn't have enough food. Or we didn't accompany him on the way. The fact that they have to declare that is an implication that maybe that is the reason, and that's the guilt that they have. The ritual ends with the words, HaKohanim Omrim B'lashon HaKodesh, the words that the Kohanim recite in Hebrew, which we already looked at before, Kaper La'amcha Yisrael Asher Padisa Hashem, Hashem, give an atonement for the Jewish people, the Holchim Lahem, and then everybody goes home. What do you make of the fact that the Kohanim, the priests, are the ones who make this final prayer that God should forgive the Jewish people? When you actually look at the text of the Chumash, it's not clear that the Kohanim are the ones who recite these words. When you look at the Chumash, the elders in Pasuk Zion are the ones that say, we didn't do it. And then in Pasuk Chet, without a new speaker, the Torah continues, and it sounds as though it's the same people saying, Kaper, forgive the Jewish people. Why are we inserting the Kohanim? Well, the more you take the approach that it's about sacrifice, maybe you'll say that the Kohanim do need to be involved because this is a sacrifice, and that's why the Kohanim need to be the ones to, give the final declaration. And after the ritual, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mechaper al Adam, God will forgive them. Shneamar, Vini Kaper Lahem Hadam, and the blood is atoned to them.